has historically been an area of collaboration among nations. The U.S. and the Soviet Union collaborated on a number of projects in space despite the tensions of the Cold War. But today, that may no longer be the case. I'm Christy Eye, and you're watching The Cost of Everything, where today, we're going to be taking a closer look at what it costs to fund the Great Space Race 2.0. The space race is heating up, and the heat isn't just coming from international rivals. Private companies have been disrupting the industry that was once under the sole purview of government agencies. Over the last decade, commercial activity in space more than tripled, growing to over $300 billion in 2020. In 2021, three companies, SpaceX, Blue Origin, and Virgin Galactic, achieved key feats in space travel previously reserved to only countries. So how were these companies able to do that? It all had to do with scope, cost efficiency, and speed. Government projects tend to be big. Think mega dams, high-speed rails, the ISS. These projects are these quantum leap projects that attempt to achieve a massive gain in a single leap. And they're funded because they are massively impressive. Unfortunately, most of them end up as being failures, as costs are never recouped. In contrast, private companies like SpaceX limit their scope and grow incrementally. First, there was a Falcon 1, then the Falcon 9, then the reusable Falcon 9, and finally, the Falcon Heavy. The company focused on solving one problem at a time, like a satellite launch, before extending it to a spacecraft and launching people. Second, you have cost efficiency. Like most things in the government, contractors are selected via bids. Right now, spacesuits are being built by 27 different companies that successfully lobbied the government for a piece of the action. In contrast, Elon Musk's spacesuits are created by one single contractor. In 118 space missions, NASA saw an average cost overrun of 90%. In contrast, over 16 missions, SpaceX only saw an average cost overrun of 1.1%. And finally, you have speed. NASA projects average about 7 years versus SpaceX projects, which average about 4 years. SpaceX has one boss who executes decisions quickly, a sharp contrast to how the chain of command within NASA's bureaucracy works. Now, to further break it down, let's bring in Hamza Hamid, co-chair of the Space Generation Advisory Council. So first off, why is the space race such a big deal? Seems like it's a big attraction for billionaires to compete over as they race to develop these rockets. But what's the end goal? And is it really something that ordinary people like you and I should even care about?
You know, for me, coming from a developing country like Pakistan, the idea of outer space was always this fantastical sort of thing where only the richest countries or the, you know, most highly developed economies had access. And also needed. But then as I grew up more and more and you know, started to work in the area of space and space law in particular, I learned that almost everybody relies on space technology for almost everything that they do on a day-to-day basis. In fact, if I just try to think back to everything that I've done today, whether that be coming to work, calling an Uber, or talking to my friends over the internet, you know, most of those activities involve some sort of communication with a satellite or reliance on space technology. And I think when you think of the, when you, you know, see why the space race is such a big deal, it's because as a community, we want to, you know, do better, develop more, have better access to others, have better access to information. And space can serve as an enabler to all of those things. In fact, from a development perspective and from the type of work that I do very often, space can make access to education, access to opportunities, even access to finance so much more open and transparent to so many people, as well as just allow people to get involved in activities that they would normally not be able to be involved in the past. And then so I think that's one reason why the space race is such a big deal. And then I guess it's just also, you know, humanity's wish or urge to always, you know, try to find out more about the universe, about where we came from, about all sorts of things that might be out there that also make it quite a big deal. So I don't think space is just the realm of billionaires and in, you know, highly developed economies. I think it's this, you know, commons, which is important for everyone and then can give benefits to everyone if utilized in the right way. Yeah.
So NASA has been called slow and antiquated compared to these new private space companies. Why is that the case when NASA had such a big head start?
If you think of the history of the space sector, then it was always dominated by big space agencies. And that made a lot of sense because whether we admit it or not, the space race started from this desire of countries to have greater superiority in terms of their defense. And so the prime initial use cases of the space sector were mostly based on defense, and hence space was closely tied to the armed forces and also tightly under the ambit of governmental institutions. At the same time, if you go back to looking at the development or start of most of these space agencies, you'll find that their primary purpose was research and you know, testing the boundaries of what's possible rather than commercial activities. So if you look at any space agency, whether that be NASA or, you know, the space agency for my country, Pakistan, which is Supalco, their primary goal is to conduct research and then facilitate an environment in which the space economy can grow. And I think most space agencies do that really, really well. They set out these ambitious programs that take a lot of testing, research, development, and then those programs and initiatives sort of motivate the rest of the community, including the private sector, to do more and grow more. And the private sector being commercially focused and profit oriented sometimes does grow at a faster speed and at a much more disruptive speed, which I think is fine. And, you know, I don't think it's a question of trying to compare space agencies to the private sector. It's about trying to figure out how all of these different parts of the space puzzle fit together, which I think is the most important thing.
And now if we have SpaceX, Blue Origin, and other private companies launching into space and handling all these satellites, telecom services, what's the point of NASA? Do we technically even need NASA anymore? And what benefits does NASA offer that private companies do not?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are several reasons why space agencies and public sector bodies generally need to continue to exist and support the advancement of space technologies. Like I said, you know, the primary goal of these agencies from their, you know, conception was to promote research and science and development and not to, you know, make a profit. And whereas the primary goal of any private sector entity is to have a commercially viable business. And so while in my opinion, you know, where the space agencies and the public sector institutions can add the most amount of value is in doing scientifically innovative things, research projects, you know, testing the boundaries of what's possible and things that are highly capital intensive and probably not very palatable for the private sector because they might not be profit generating immediately. So for me, the space agencies and public sector bodies in the space sector play that role of where they test out, where they come up with the best and the brightest ideas in terms of technology and then, you know, engage the private sector or push the private sector to turn those ideas and technologies into viable business models. So I certainly think that, you know, private companies such as SpaceX or Blue Origin always seek to complement the strategies or the visions that space agencies put forward and then bring together and complement their work rather than compete with them. And I think it's how well within any government or within any country, the private sector works with the governmental institutions that determine the success of that particular country's space program. Yeah.
So while its primary purpose is to further space exploration, NASA has contributed quite a few inventions that benefit the public space today. Everyday items like memory foam mattresses, freeze-dried food, firefighting equipment, emergency space blankets, all of that started from NASA. Have private space companies contributed any benefits to the public?
Absolutely. I think a lot of private companies have dedicated programs and products that are designed to benefit the global community. A good example that I can point to, for example, is a lot of these private space companies that are working towards launching constellations that would provide internet access to areas of the world that might not be served with broadband. So a good example is Starlink from SpaceX, which really does open up potential that had never existed before, right? It was almost impossible to get internet services in rural areas or where broadband service providers really couldn't make a good case to provide high-speed internet. And SpaceX, with its Starlink satellites, really provides a novel solution to this problem, which is internet enabled by small satellites in lower Earth orbit. And I think that's fantastic. And there are so many parts of the world, including in developing countries, where access to internet is a big, big problem. And it's largely an infrastructure problem and a problem that is very hard to fix for developing countries and can be remedied through space technology, such as a series of satellites that provide internet. Another good example is the use of satellite data in disaster mitigation. So if you think of one of the main uses of satellite technology is Earth observation and remote sensing, which is when these satellites look down at Earth and help and provide data to both the government institutions as well as to, you know, private entities regarding weather patterns, regarding the movement of rivers, regarding, you know, rainfall, soil conditions, all of which have a big, big public sector benefit. And so I do think there are lots of examples of the private sector opening up its data to government entities, to the public, to allow for things like disaster management and relief at the same time as providing services that are just beneficial to the public generally, rather than just to make a profit. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Hamza Hamid, for your insights. But we'll have you back again on the Space Race after the break. That's right, when we come back, countries are racing to launch their own space stations instead of collaborating together in the International Space Station. But at what cost? Don't go away.
I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. Wherever people long to be free, they will find a friend in the United States.
Dentro la primavera araba e le varie rivolte nei vari paesi si sono inseriti i giochi delle grandi potenze, dei servizi segreti.
Color revolutions is one among several means to reach the goal of conquering foreign lands and bringing them under the helm of US Western economic interests.
Si può pensare ad un'architettura globale di democrazia.
Le rivoluzioni colorate sono un tassello del soft power americano.
The final goal of these theme revolutions is to ensure that there are no independent players in the world anymore.
The International Space Station, or the ISS, is the only space station that's currently fully operational. The US, Russia, Japan, Europe, and Canada collaborate on the ISS. And currently, Russia owns about a quarter of the ISS and is responsible for navigation and control of the spacecraft. But it had announced that it would end cooperation with the ISS after 2024 and instead build its own space station due to sanctions imposed by the West. This is a heavy blow as it is not yet clear if the space station can remain operational without Russia. Instead, Russia's space agency unveiled a model of its own space station dubbed Ross, suggesting that Moscow is serious about going at it alone. China was denied access to the ISS program and is currently building its own space station called Tiangong, translated as Celestial Palace, which should be fully operational by the end of 2022. Once it becomes operational, China is expected to be the only country to operate its own space station. Now to further break it down, let's bring back in Hamza Hamid, co-chair of the Space Generation Advisory Council. So the ISS is the most expensive item ever built and costs NASA about $4 billion a year to operate. What does that money go towards and why is it so expensive?
So I think the International Space Station, or the ISS, is a phenomenal example of multilateral cooperation and how things can get done when, you know, the most advanced space economies of the world collaborate and do a mission together. It served as humankind's outpost in space for decades now and is really fundamental to inspiring the future of, you know, thinkers, students, young professionals in the space industry. I think it's a super important project because it enables us to test technologies in outer space, which is not an environment we generally have access to here on Earth. I think it serves as a testing, as a station for experiments, whether those be scientific experiments within various different fields. So there have been projects on the ISS that have involved, you know, agriculture, medicine, as well as physics and biology, all of which have shown results that were not possible on Earth. So I think it adds a lot of value with that. Then I think the ISS has served as an outpost to astronauts to go to space and then, you know, look back at Earth to understand how the feeling of being in space feels like. And that whole collaborative atmosphere between different countries has also enabled countries that would normally not have access to space to have one of their astronauts in space, which I think is excellent. With regard to why it costs so much, I think it's an incredibly cost-expensive operation to run because it's based in outer space. I think all of that equipment costs a lot. I think the cost of a launch is really, really high, and all the astronauts in the ISS need to be provided resources such as food, water, anything else that they need from Earth. And then so resupplying resources to the ISS is obviously an expensive process. Then the ISS is navigated through a ground station. So obviously providing ground station support is an expensive tool. And just the upkeep of a space station is obviously a very expensive activity. And if you ask me whether or not it's worth it, I think it's completely worth it. It's inspired so many people to build more business models for space. and it's great, and it's a symbol of cooperation like we've never seen before. A good example of a recent use of the ISS for innovation was when a new space company used the ISS as a launch port, right? So I'm sure you've seen videos where small satellites were literally thrown out of the ISS and deployed into orbit as an innovative mechanism to have satellites in space. And then that was only possible through having a station like the ISS out there. Yeah.
So while we have a couple of these alliances and space blocks here, you have the Russia-China block, the Arab Space Coordination Group, and the Euro block, et cetera. And while these blocks are great and allow for nations to collaborate closely, do you think that there's a possibility that the more rigid these alliances become, the more likely conflict is to ensue between the blocks?
So I think that's a great question, right? I think political powers and you know, political factors are at play in every industry. And you always find that as the importance of a sector grows, more and more countries want to explore it. And often countries tend to form blocs or alliances to try and further their common goals or you know, outcomes for the space, for any sector. I think space is the same, where you see a lot of, you know, countries with common missions or common ideologies grouping together in what you described as these blocs to try to jointly explore space. And I think cooperation and collaboration is great. And I, in my work on a day-to-day basis, we encourage cooperation and collaboration on as multilateral a level as possible, but then also on regional and bilateral levels. Whether or not that leads to conflict in space, I think the answer to that is the same as whatever, you know, geopolitical situations are going on around the world at any given time. I don't think space has any particularity in this whole block diplomacy that goes on around the world at the UN or at other international organizations. And I think it's just one part of the bigger picture. I obviously cannot specifically point to any, you know, geopolitical blocks and in the roles that they play in the global space economy. But I do think collaboration and cooperation is the way forward. And there are rules in place, particularly in the space sector, in the form of the Outer Space Treaty, as to how, you know, a country or even a group of countries can and should use space. And then within these rules, you'll find lots of provisions relating to things such as the importance of demilitarization of space, no use of space for you know, purposes of placing weapons on celestial bodies and things like that. So there are rules when it comes to defense and space and how they're interlinked. And I would imagine those rules to be followed and for space to continue to be a collaborative and cooperative sphere for most countries, yeah.
And now, while previous space endeavors were in the name of scientific exploration and discovery, today's space endeavors have an element of technology, security, and communication in them. Does that change the nature of cooperation and collaboration between even friendly partners?
It would be wrong to suggest that security was not always a part of space exploration. I think it always was. The space race was, you know, a big part of the Cold War. And since then, security has always and defense have always been key elements of any country's development in the space sector. Whether or not that changes the ways countries collaborate, I don't know. I think the answer to that, again, is that space will always continue to be part of broader alliances and friendships that countries will build or, you know, break off. I think it will always continue to have, I think the impact of space technology, particularly in defense, will continue to grow as science and technologies deployed in space grow, space technology now plays a much bigger part in conflicts, in issues that come up. And then so obviously that will come up as a domain where countries might want to compete or have their own systems in place for reliability or further safety and security. I don't think it particularly impacts cooperation and collaboration between friendly states as that's in the interest of the broader community. I think you'll always find that the defense sector is separate from commercial private space. And then that's purely for this reason. Countries like to deal with their defense sector in a particular way and then promote the growth of space technology and then space science in a different manner. And while that's not the most ideal solution in many countries, most countries still work like that. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Hamza Hamid, for joining us today. While NASA received $23.3 billion in funding for 2021, SpaceX raised a mere $1.5 billion in the same year. But more money doesn't mean it's better. It's interesting that in the 21st century, the space race is no longer between countries, but instead between three private space companies: Musk's SpaceX, Bezos' Blue Origin, and Branson's Virgin Galactic. All three companies are pushing the boundary of humanity's reach beyond Earth, and each of them have a distinct goal and vision in mind. SpaceX wants to land on Mars by 2024. Blue Origin, they aim to make space travel accessible to citizens and obtain new energy sources and materials from the solar system. While Virgin Galactic, they're focusing on suborbital space experiences that include supersonic transport liners flying at Mach 3. That would make the New York to London flight only 2 hours, faster than the now retired Concorde. And now the success of these companies, they can benefit people greatly as it opens the doors for more advanced technologies to be adapted for the daily life. But until that happens, many critics claim that space exploration is a waste of taxpayer money that could be otherwise be redirected towards more impactful endeavors to help humanity on Earth. I'm Christy Yai. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you back here next time on The Cost of Everything.